Okay, I welcome everyone back to the next, our newest session. Let me clear this chat. Oh, Rabbi Kelman is here with us. I don't know if Rabbi Kelman wants to say hello or anything. Okay, well, maybe not, or maybe he'll get on in a little bit. Welcome everyone back to, it's probably, maybe the fifth year now of Torah in Motion. This will be a class, a smaller class of six. Maybe that is why we have a smaller crowd. I'm not sure, but I know more people have signed up and will be coming. We are going to, this semester, start with the Rav Avraham Shmuel Sofer, the Ketav Sofer. We're picking up where we left off. I only have, I think one class today on the Ketav Sofer. Then we're going to have a class or two about a figure, Moshe Kunitz, a relatively minor figure, but you'll see how he fits into what we've been doing, because he also is Hungarian. And then we move on to a major figure. That's Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, the Or Sameach, who will take us to the end of the semester, maybe even into the following semester. The following semester, we're going to do Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin, and I'm still not sure about the others. I might do Rav Aaron Cutler. There's a number of figures I've been thinking about. Maybe the Netziv, Natali C. Yehuda Berlin. But let us get right to it. We're in the middle of our discussion of the Ketav Sofer, the son of Rav Moshe Sofer. There's his picture. I'm going to erase his picture now for the time being. And we spoke about the biography of him. We spoke about his activity in Pressburg. So I'm just going to pick up right where we left off. And I ended by saying that he stood in the forefront of opposition to the reform in Hungary and what the reform very much wanted to do. That was create a rabbinical seminary in Hungary. Now, what happened was that in 1868, the government called a congress. It told the Jewish community of Hungary, the entire Jewish community, they want a congress of Jews to come together in Budapest, and because they wanted a group of Jews that they could deal with as the go-between between the government, and they wanted to organize the Jewish community. This is something that governments have done all throughout Europe. Before this Jewish Congress, the Orthodox had their own gathering, a mini-Congress, I think you can call it, and the Ketav Sofer was chosen as the president of the rabbinical committee that would put forth the Orthodox position. The delegates to the Congress in Budapest were to be both, actually in those days they just called it Pest, because they hadn't joined them together yet, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, in 1868, correct me if I'm wrong, it hadn't yet been joined. But there were to be both lay delegates and rabbis. And the Chassam Sofer was chosen as the rabbi, the leader of the rabbis. Sorry, it was in Buda. The gathering was in Buda. Now, at this gathering, we already can see disagreements between the different segments of the Orthodox world in Hungary. Last class, we spoke about the Michalowicz decrees, how the more extremist elements of Hungarian Jewry, in particular the Hasidic elements, came out with all sorts of proclamations that if anyone doesn't follow these proclamations, they're not regarded as a faithful Jew. We spoke about them, having weddings in the synagogue, having choirs, all these sorts of things. And at this gathering in Buda, in addition to the Ketav Sofer, who else was in attendance there? Israel Hildesheimer. Israel Hildesheimer was rabbi in Eisenstadt. Today, it's in Austria, and then it was actually in Hungary, that it was considered part of the Hungarian, even though the Austrian Empire was in charge, he ruled over Hungary as well. There's no country Austria-Hungary. You have Austria, and then you also have Hungary, and Hungary had borders, and it had a parliament, which is subject to the Austrian, which is subject to the emperor, Franz Josef, and Eisenstadt was in the borders of Hungary. Hildesheimer was there at the gathering, And already there we see, as I said, the disputes between Hildesheimer, and not just Hildesheimer, the Ketav Sofer as well, and the extreme rabbis, the Hungarian rabbi, the Hasidic rabbis. For example, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, who already for years now has had in Eisenstadt a yeshiva with secular studies, which created all sorts of controversy. Go back to the second year of these courses, of his lectures on Hildesheimer. He supports, at this gathering, the creation of a rabbinical seminary by the Orthodox. That is, an institution where, in addition to learning traditional Jewish subjects, Shas and Poskim, they would also prepare modern rabbis, they would take courses in history and preaching, and it would be an institution designed to train rabbis so that rabbis could serve communities. The Hasidim, the extremist elements, were obviously very opposed to this. The Ketav Sofer was in the middle, and he was ready to compromise. We already saw last semester how the Ketav Sofer was very close to Hildesheimer and agreed to have Hildesheimer come to Pressburg and take over the yeshiva and institute secular studies in the yeshiva. So we see that the Ketav Sofer, although he was in the middle, tilted much more to Hildesheimer. He was chosen, incidentally, not by a vote, but by acclamation by everyone. Even the extremist elements thought that they could work with him. Now, at the gathering, they saw that this was not correct and that there was a problem from their perspective with the Ketav Sofer. Why? Because the Ketav Sofer proclaimed that since the government was interested in rabbis who had secular studies, who had secular degrees, if the government were to issue an order about this, that is, the Ketav Sofer was not saying that everyone should study secular subjects, like Hildesheimer was, but he said that if the government were to issue an order that they want rabbis to have secular degrees, then this would be Dina de Machusadina, this would be the law of the land, and we would follow it. And it's not a problem, it's not what we prefer, but if the government insists on it, we'll live with it. And he said that we will appoint teachers to just teach them secular subjects. Upon hearing this, one of the Hasidic Rebbes, his name was we call him the Admor of Liska, L-I-S-K-A. I believe there still is a figure who calls himself the Admor of Liska today, a descendant. This Admor of Liska in Hungary, in the Hasidic sections of Hungary, he was one of the important Admorim. There weren't most of the extremist elements in Hungary were really not Hasidic, or I shouldn't say most, and probably half of them weren't. There was plenty of extremism in Hungary, people like the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and Hillel Lichtenstein, who were not Hasidic, but there also was a strong extremist Hasidic element. He had been acclaimed, elected by acclamation, vice president of this rabbinical gathering. That is, the Ketav Sofer was one, and he was two, to balance off the Ketav Sofer. He gets up, very angry, and declares that the only thing a rabbi needs to know when it comes to secular studies is how to read the Latin alphabet so that he can sign his name in an official German or Hungarian document. But the rabbis have no need to know anything about secular subjects. As I said, just the ability to sign their name. Now, obviously, you're not going to have any compromise here when Hildesheimer is arguing that in order to fight the reform, we need to have rabbis who have doctorates and who know all about secular subjects, who can reach out to the masses. And here you have a Hasidic Rebbe who is saying that the rabbis should be completely ignorant of anything but Torah study. Turns out that there was a vote, and the extremist position actually won. And the vote was to forbid inclusion of secular studies in the curriculum. Meaning, no matter what, that this is to be refused. So what would happen if the government instituted it? They don't spell this out, but I think it's pretty obvious. This would be regarded as a Shas HaShmad, a Gzeres HaShmad, a time of persecution, and when they say that we will forbid secular studies, it means we will try our best to forbid it. So that would include lying to the government, telling it they were offering secular studies when they weren't, trying to have underground yeshivas, that is, yeshivas that are not publicly known, so that the government doesn't recognize these yeshivas or doesn't know of their existence, to try to do everything, or even perhaps relocating the yeshivas outside of Hungary into Moravia, perhaps, or another place, to try to do everything possible to prevent this Shas HaShemad. We remember what happened in Lithuania. The yeshiva closed down. The Volozhin yeshiva, the Netziv, closed down the yeshiva rather than institute secular studies. Now we know a lot more about that incident, that the government really wanted the yeshiva to close down, and forcing them to have secular studies was the means to do this. We've spoken about this. But the Netziv didn't know this. He just knew that they were requiring an enormous amount of secular studies. It wasn't just an hour or two a day. In previous years, he had sanctioned some secular studies, but he had to close the yeshiva rather than have an institution that wouldn't be worthy of the name. Getting back to the Congress. After this, after you have this rabbinical gathering, the Congress meets in 1868. The delegates were elected by city based upon the population in the various cities. And it turns out that the neologues, who are usually called reformers, but as we saw already, from our perspective, it would be better to call them conservative, even right-wing conservative, if we're comparing them to the way Jews live today. However, in the context of Hungary, they were regarded as reformers, even though they weren't radical reformers. There were radical reformers. There were reformers in Hungary, short-lived, who wanted to move the Shabbos, abolish circumcision, and they didn't really last very long. So what was left were conservative reformers, I guess you can call them, but they were regarded as reformed, no different than Abraham Geiger by the Orthodox. 50% of the delegates were neologue, that is, reformers. 40% of the delegates represented the Orthodox. And 10% of the delegates were by those people who were undecided. That is, they voted for delegates neither Orthodox nor Reform. They wanted something in the middle. We see that out of this will come a completely new movement. The Orthodox were themselves split between the moderate wing, as I said, led by Hildesheimer, and the more militant extremist wing, led by, as I said, the Admor of Liska. There was a great Rav named Rav Yirmiyahu Lev of, I don't even know how to pronounce the, in Hungarian, Uzsili, I think is how you pronounce it in Hungary. He wrote the Divrei Yirmiyahu on the Rambam. It's very ironic because after the conference, when there is this great split in Hungarian Jewry between the Orthodox, the neologues, and the so-called the status quo, the ones who won't commit either way, this city, Rav Yirmiyahu's city, decides to remain status quo. And his son, who was also a great Rav and author of Svarim, remained the Rav of a community that was regarded as an outcast by the Orthodox. We'll get back to that soon. The Ksav Sofer aligned with the moderate Orthodox led by Hildesheimer. How do we know this? The Ksav Sofer wasn't a delegate himself, but he did remain in Buda during the entire Congress. The reason we know how he aligned with is because the Pressburg delegates were aligned with Hildesheimer, and they were taking all their orders from the Ksav Sofer. The Congress never gets off the ground right from the beginning. The Orthodox declare that they cannot participate in a Congress together with the neologues unless the neologues agree from the get-go that they will follow the Shulchan Aruch. It turns out that the moderate neologues, the moderate reformers, were willing to agree to this. I mean, if you know what a neologue shul looked like, there was a machitza. I shouldn't say there was a machitza. You didn't have machitzas in those days. You had women up in a balcony. A machitza was not regarded as kosher because you could see the women, and or unless it was completely to the ceiling, in which case it's not a machitza. You didn't have machitzas in Hungary. What you had is you had in the smaller shuls, you had women in a completely separate room where you'd have maybe little holes that they could see through, or they would be on a balcony. The sort of mechitzas that we have in all our modern Orthodox shulmets, forbidden. But even Israel Hildesheimer, who was the most moderate, he agreed with the Michalowicz decrees on this matter. They regarded it as a lack of tzniut, a lack of tznius, that you can actually see women, remember the women on the same level, and you could see them during davening. That to them was completely inappropriate. As I mentioned last semester, people are under this mistaken perception that when the Satmar Rebbe had his famous argument with Moshe Feinstein, which the Satmar Rebbe said that the mechitza needs to be such a way that you can't see the women. And Moshe says, no, just, I don't remember what he said, 60 inches or something. It's not about seeing, it's about mingling. And this is often portrayed as, the great post-sager of Moshe against the extremist Satmar Rav. The fact is that in Hungary, all the rabbis, even the liberal rabbis, opposed mechitzas. The idea was that a woman has to either be up in the balcony where you can't see them really, or complete, and even in the balcony they had this lattice work. So when they stood up, unless they were very tall, you couldn't see them, or they had to be in a completely separate room. So when you think of it, even the Neolog shuls had women in the balcony. What's the problem with agreeing to follow the Shulchan Aruch? The only problematic thing these Neologs did, for the most part, was that they had an organ in Shul on Shabbos played by a non-Jew. How does that violate the Shulchan Aruch? It doesn't violate the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the liberal neologues, they were, of course, looking towards the future, that there's all sorts of things that they're going to eventually get rid of, or at least they hope to. It turns out that the population in Hungary was quite conservative, with a small c, and they did not want to move in the direction of reform. But most of the neologues did not want to commit themselves from the beginning that they are automatically bound by the Shulchan Aruch, but there, as I said, there were some moderate neologues who did agree to it. By the way, during the chief rabbinate of Joseph Hertz, there were great disputes between him and the more right-wing elements. There was a time when the right-wing elements wanted Hertz to agree, even though Hertz was an Orthodox rabbi with a Beis Din, a very respected Beis Din. They wanted him to commit to follow that all his decisions will be in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch, and he refused to. He said, from an Orthodox perspective, he refused to. He said that there are some times we don't follow the Shulchan Aruch, and it could be that there'll be times, Shas HaTchak, where we have to depart from the Shulchan Aruch. You can find, for example, maybe the Vilna Gaon, or you find one of the commentaries who disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch, and we won't follow the Shulchan Aruch. There are plenty of constitutions in America of shuls that do say that we will follow the Shulchan Aruch, and yet that is not true, because there's plenty of cases where they don't follow the Shulchan Aruch simply because even the Shulchan Aruch says if there was a minhag, a practice, before the Shulchan Aruch was written, that this practice can continue, and he's not coming to uproot practices that were already in existence. And some of you might know that one day I will get to this long article, which I've written many pages already, but I'm so busy doing other things I had to put it on the back burner, about things that modern Orthodox as Orthodox in modern times, I don't mean modern Orthodox per se, Haredim, Chassidim, there are loads and loads of examples of things that we do that is Orthodox Jews in America and Israel, which is not in accord with the Shulchan Aruch. And I don't mean Lechumra, I mean Lekula. And not just Ashkenazim, Sephardim as well. Although today everyone speaks, I'm going to have another post coming on the Sephardim blog. I hope to finish it this week, and maybe it'll appear next week. What I'm going to mention right now is not going to appear in this segment. It'll be in the next segment, which hopefully will come soon afterwards. Everyone, if they know anything today about Sephardim, they know that whereas Ashkenazim don't have to eat God kosher, and by the way, I hope some of you are coming on my Italian trip, because you'll see something in Italy that the only place you see is in Israel. Well, you see it in Europe also, but you don't see it in America. You see it in Israel as well. All the kosher restaurants in Italy, under the supervision of the Beis Din, none of them are glatt. It's just regular kosher. You see the same thing, by the way, if you go to the Netherlands, other places, but I don't want to, I'm glad in our ads we say strictly kosher food. We don't say glatt kosher, only glatt kosher, because that would be sheker, because there isn't glatt in Italy. But the truth of the matter is, as we've said many times, all the meat in America and the chickens in America that say glatt kosher on it, they're not glatt kosher anyway. It's just they call it glatt kosher. What is glatt? Glatt is beis yosef. Beis yosef is means there's no adhesion. So everyone assumes that the Sfardim, because Sfardim follow the Shulchan Aruch, they have to only eat beis yosef. They can't even eat the meat that's sold. I was going to say Rabashkin. Rabashkin doesn't sell meat anymore. Meal Mart. Or whatever ones you get in the supermarket that say glatt. Sfardim, we're told, can't eat them because it's not real glatt. When Meal Mart OU says it's glatt, it just means that they're more careful. However, the truth of the matter is that until recent times, despite what the Shulchan Aruch said, most Sfardim, I'm going to say most, even though this summer I was told by the Rav and the Shochet of Livorno that no Sfardim kept glatt. I will say most Sfardim did not keep glatt. In North Africa, no one kept glatt. In other places in the Sephardic world, in America, they didn't keep glatt. In Italy, they didn't keep glatt. There's a tshuva by Rav, the Rav of Venice, Rav Shmuel Abu'ab. So people did not keep glatt. Even though it says in the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Avad Yosef pushed this so much that it's now become standard. The Syrian community never kept glatt. So here's an example of where the Syrian community in America, I'm not sure what they did yet Syria, but based upon the Rav of Livorno, who's a Sfardi, whose grandfather was also a Shochet, assured me that this business of Sfardim doing Beis Yosef glatt, this is only due to Rav Avad Yosef, and he told me his grandfather was a big Shochet, told him that no Sephardic communities, with the exception of the island of Djerba in Tunisia, were makpid on glatt kosher. The reason I maybe doubt it is because I sort of think that in the land of Israel they were makpid on Beis Yosef. I know in North Africa they weren't. But that's what he says. Larry points out that the charter of the Jewish Center in New York, which is part of the laws of New York State, requires that the synagogue be conducted according to Shulchan Aruch as glossed by the Ramah. That's interesting. Yeah, there's plenty of shuls that have that, and yet we could find plenty of examples where they don't follow the Shulchan Aruch or the Ramah. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a responsum in which he says that when you speak of the Shulchan Aruch, that we're bound by the Shulchan Aruch, you don't just mean the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. It also includes the commentaries. So when you say if you want to argue for an expansive definition of the Shulchan Aruch, and that when you say that we follow the Shulchan Aruch, it means the Shulchan Aruch, including, let's say, the Magen Avraham, the Shach, the Taz, etc., then you could argue that we follow the Shulchan Aruch. But if you mean literally, as you say, the charter, the Shulchan Aruch, or the Ramah, as I said, there's plenty of times in all sorts of halachot where the minhag is not like the Shulchan Aruch or the Ramah. There's sometimes that maybe the Shach or the Taz or the Magen Avraham or some of the other commentaries, or the Vilna Gaon. We have things that we do in accordance with the Vilna Gaon, which is not in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch. I've mentioned many examples. Let me mention an example I don't know if I've said before. According to the Shulchan Aruch, anytime you eat a food that's wet, you have to wash for it. No one disputes this. Even if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, no one even disputes it among the commentaries. And yet we only commemorate this practice once a year on Pesach. And there's all sorts of discussions in the Achronim why no one seems to do this. According to the halacha, Shulchan Aruch, you can't lend money to anyone if there's no witnesses present, and no one really follows that. According to the Shulchan Aruch, you have to leave a corner of your house empty in commemoration of the Beis Hamikdash. And already a few hundred years ago, people are asking, why doesn't anyone follow this? So there are loads of halachot, which for one reason or another seem to have fallen by the wayside. Not to mention the other halachot, which we're more stringent than the Shulchan Aruch. In any event, getting back to where we were, so the majority of the neologues refuse to go along with this. Furthermore, the extremists on the Orthodox side also didn't want to have a modus vivendi. As far as they were concerned, they didn't want to sit with the neologues, even if the neologues would agree to be guided by the Shulchan Aruch. They didn't want to sit with them because they're still dealing with people who have organs in their synagogue and believe in secular studies and all sorts of things. So both the extreme on the Neolog side and the extreme on the Orthodox side ensured that this would never pass. and the Orthodox group, when it didn't pass, that is the right-wing Orthodox, stormed out of the Congress saying that we cannot sit with these people. The putting on the agenda that the neologues have to agree to be guided by the Shulchan Aruch, they knew, Greenwald, Yekusiel Greenwald writes about this, they knew that this would never pass, and that would give them the opportunity to leave. They march out of the Congress, and they actually went to the emperor to tell him that they could not sit with these people, that it's a violation of their freedom of conscience, and actually Franz Josef accepted their viewpoint. But we'll get to that in a second. The rest, a minority of the Orthodox, including Hildesheimer's group, with the exception of five members of Hildesheimer's delegation, that is five people who are loyal to Hildesheimer, they left the Congress. The rest stayed, trying to reach an agreement. And the followers from Pressburg of the Chasam Sofer, that is the followers of the Chasam Sofer, of the Ksav Sofer from Pressburg, they stayed with Hildesheimer. Yet they were not successful to come to any sort of agreement, being that they were now a minority, a tiny minority, since most of the Orthodox had left. The neologues were able to vote on anything they wanted, and they agreed to establish a network of Jewish schools, non-Orthodox Jewish schools, and to open a rabbinical seminary, a seminary which would not be Orthodox. And you know where they got the money to do this? In 1848, there had been the revolts against all throughout Europe, but against Franz Josef as well, and the Jewish community was involved with this in Hungary. And the Hungarian Jewish community was fined an enormous sum of money for taking part in the revolts, but Franz Josef was a very good man to the Jews. He took this money, and he actually put it away. He put it in the money he received, it turns out that they were not able to pay off all the money anyway, but the money they received, he put it aside, and 15 or 16 years later after the fine, or more, 18 years later after the fine was levied, he gave them this money, and it was from this money that they were able to have the seed money for the schools and for the rabbinical seminary. However, the Orthodox, who saw that they were not represented, they were given permission by the government to separate and create their own organization. The government originally wanted one national Jewish body, which would decide matters affecting the entire Jewish community. They could deal with this organization, just like in Germany. However, the government saw that this would not work and was a violation of freedom of conscience. And therefore, the Orthodox were given permission to set up their own framework. So now you have two separate frameworks of the Jewish community in Hungary. You have the Orthodox, and you have the Neolog. So you have separate communities here. This is before Hirsch is given permission to create his separate communities in Germany. This means that every city, you would have, let's say, the rabbi or the majority, if they were Orthodox, they belong to the Orthodox community, which has a national organization. And if the majority is Neolog, to the Neolog organization. And if there is a synagogue, let's say, of Orthodox Jews in a Neolog community, then this synagogue will associate with the Orthodox organization. And that was 90% of the Jews. And remember I said that there were 10% who before the Congress really didn't want to commit either way? There still were these 10%, and they refused to commit either to the Orthodox organization or to the Neolog organization. They just remained, they had no organization at first. They were just communities that were not members of either national organization, and they called themselves status quo ante. That is, they believed in following the way things were done before the Congress, and they became known as the status quo communities. Later, they formed an organization of status quo communities. In a future class, we will, I think, deal with a status quo rabbi, so we can talk more about it then, but let me just give you a few minutes on this, because it's a very interesting phenomenon. Today, if you look at it, status quo rabbis appear to be more modern Orthodox types. The status quo communities, and there were some great communities, where Debrecen, for example, was a status quo community. Satmar had a status quo community. The rabbis were Talmidei Chachamim. The people were Shomer Shabbos. they just didn't want to have the separatism. They wanted to have their own communities without being told by a national organization. You even had certain Hasidic communities which were status quo because they didn't want to be together with the non-Hasidim. The Orthodox, however, made it an obligation that if you don't join the Orthodox organization, that is the framework, you're poresh min hatzibur, you're separated from the community, and your community has the status of heresy, of heretics. And ironically, it was Shimshon Raphael Hirsch that came to the defense of the status quo communities. He said that in Germany, it's important to separate because we can't be with the reformers. But what's wrong with the status quo communities? The Rav is a real Rav, and the community is orthodox, because in Hungary, Orthodox means political Orthodox. He says the community, the status quo communities, are Shomer Shabbos, they're Torah true communities. So how can you say if they don't join a political organization that they are no longer regarded as reputable? But that's exactly what they said in Hungary, and they put a cherem on these communities. If you were a shochet in a status quo community, you were no longer regarded as a valid shochet. If you were a rav in a status quo community, you were no longer regarded as a valid rav. It's the equivalent as if today the Agudas Yisrael and the OU said that anyone who doesn't join our organization, anyone who doesn't join the OU, your shul is not considered a reliable shul. And your hechsher cannot be trusted, and your shlita can't be trusted, and your rav cannot be trusted. Because they, and from one perspective, you could say this is crazy. But on the other hand, they said we are fighting a battle against the non-Orthodox. Either you are with us or you're against us. Now is the time when you say everyone has to come with me and be on my side. Like after the Egel Hazav or something like that, you have to declare which side you're on. And there were a few great rabbanim who didn't go to the Orthodox. But over time, almost most of the status quo communities, or at least a good percentage of them, went Orthodox because there was no future. And the responsa literature of the Hungarian rabbis are full of questions of shochtim, who want to leave the status quo because they can't get shiduchim for their children. And, they want to move to another community. What's their tshuva? What do they have to do? Now, what's their tshuva? These are religious people, Shomer Shabbos people, and yet they were given all sorts of penances, and sometimes they weren't given any penances. They were simply told that you served a status quo community, so you no longer have any ne'amanus. This summer, we visited one of the status quo shuls. It's called the Rumbach Synagogue, and as I said, it had very nice, fine rabbanim, though, who were educated in places like the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. And the Pressburg yeshiva, but not the more right-wing yeshivas. Because the Ksav Sofer, by the way, one more thing, and this is how Hungarian Jewry remained up until World War II. There was division into the three, the Orthodox, the status quo, and the Neolog. And the great irony today is that if you go to Hungary as we were last summer, and I hope some of you will join us this summer, after the war, everything was in a state of confusion because the Jewish community is very small, and you have, for example, these synagogues, which one of the synagogues, which is now a Chabad synagogue, which is run by a great Rav, a great Talmud Chacham named Oberlander, that was actually a neolog. That was a neolog shul after the war, because the communists said it has to be Neolog. Another Lubavitch shul, a very great, beautiful shul, that was a status quo synagogue. So today the terms have no meaning, but the organization still officially exists. So it's a Chabad shul, it's no different than any shul, but since technically it's a status quo shul, that's a very good thing for the Chabad, because they can get money. Remember that the government still will divide it. They'll divide, some money will go to status quo, some will go to Orthodox, and if you want to, you already have a few Orthodox synagogues. If you don't want to have to split up the pot among too many shuls, so just take the status quo shul. The term today has no meaning. But I heard from the Rav of Budapest, the Chabad Rav of Budapest, that since there's some anti-Chabad sentiment in Budapest, someone actually asked the Rav of the Orthodox, the Rav of Kaczynski shul, could he go into the Chabad shul? because there's a chayram, you know, against going into the neolog and the status quo shuls. And the Rav said, no, of course you can go into the shul. It's not relevant anymore today. Because the Kassav Sofer didn't join with the Hasidim and had a more moderate perspective, from the perspective of the Hasidim, maybe it's a little hard be hard to grasp this because we look up to the Kassav Sofer, but he was regarded as basically a renegade of sorts. Not a complete renegade like Israel Hildesheimer, but as one who had no Yirat Shamayim. We're talking about the Kassav Sofer here. There was in the Yaakov Rosenheim Festschrift, one of his students wrote about stories of the Kassav Sofer, and he tells a whole story here, it's on page 169, how a certain chassid told the Kassav Sofer to his face. The Kassav Sofer asked him, you know, tell me honestly, what do you think I have Yirat Shamayim? And the chassid replied, no, the chassidim do not think that you, do not regard you as a Yirat Shamayim. However, the Kassav Sofer, because he was willing to work with the government, and although they did not institute secular studies in the yeshiva buildings, as we spoke last semester, they did permit students to get secular studies. They arranged it that you can get secular studies, get your degrees at the same time. In fact, you needed to get your degree. You needed to get your secular degree at the same time you were in the yeshiva in order to receive something which was only to be found in Pressburg. That is an exemption from the draft. And the Kassav Sofer thought that the government never issued a decree that you have to have secular studies in Pressburg. He thought they might before the Congress, but they did say that if you want to be exempted from the draft, you need to have the officially recognized Institute of Theological Training. That is, so Pressburg had to become such a school, and if it was such an Institute of Theological Training, those studying for the rabbinate had to have a certain level. They had to pass the equivalent of the gymnasium. So therefore, the Kassav Sofer agreed that secular studies for his students was acceptable in order to have the yeshiva in which the students can study and not worry about the draft. I mean, if you have to worry about the draft, one day you're learning. The next day you get a letter from the government. You have to appear before the draft boards. And what do? The same thing happened in Russia. You immediately need to escape. In Russia, that's all these people then come to America or go to England, escaping the draft, because no yeshiva bachar ever went to the army. And in Hungary, you'd have to leave. And the Kassav Sofer didn't think that you could run a quality yeshiva, basically trying to undercut what the government was trying to achieve. And the Kassav Sofer remains not much longer after the Congress, and he passes away. There is a description of the Kassav Sofer's funeral. And I'm not going to read it, but I'm going to read you one little thing, because I learned something from this description which I had no idea about. And I wonder if anyone listening right now knows what I'm going to tell you. It appears in the introduction of Kassav Sofer on the Torah. It talks about the funeral and the eulogies, etc., etc. And then right at the end, it talks about, and all the stores were closed, everyone come out to the funeral, which is what you'd expect from a well-respected rav of a community. And then it talks about how, right during the funeral, let me find the exact line, they declared that they accept upon themselves in the place of the Kassav Sofer, his son, the Shevet Sofer. And how do they declare this? I mean, this is how they do this at the, right at the funeral. How do they declare it? By proclaiming, Yechi Adonenu Morenu V'Rabbeinu Le'olam. Now, why this was an insight to me is because I think everyone knows that the Chabad, the Messianists, after every one of their davenings, they scream this out loud, Yechi Adonenu Morenu V'Rabbeinu. Melech HaMashiach Le'olam, or Le'olam Vaed. I heard this summer in Venice. I invite all of you to come on our trip to Venice. It's very unusual. The only Chabad presence there, and it's a big Chabad presence there because they have a yeshiva there, as well as a shul, is Messianist. And after every tefillah, they scream out, Yechi Adonenu Moreinu V'Rabbeinu Melech HaMashiach Le'olam Vaed. I did not daven there when I was there for Shabbos. I kept away from there, even though I made a very good friend when I was there. He's a mashkiach. I'm not going to tell you which organization he's a mashkiach for. He's a big Litvish, a Talmud Chacham from Eretz Yisrael. He comes to Italy a lot because they're doing right now the Pesach. They're making stuff for Pesach. I spent a lot of time with him over Shabbos. He's closer to Chaim Kanievsky. I think he's a bit of a extremist myself, though. He's trying to convince me the whole time I'm there that you can't trust the OU's hashkacha. And he's explaining all the reasons why the OU is an unreliable hashkacha. But be that as it may, I enjoyed it very much. He was davening with Chabad. And then he would tell me afterwards all the stuff that's going on. So I had a long talk with him, by the way, because he's a bit of a post-sake as well. And he explained to me, I was wondering, does he think it's a problem? He says, no. You don't have to worry about David Berger. It's not a problem. They just have a little mishigas. So finally, I was in Venice like 4 days. Literally the last day I was there. The last Ma'ariv, my Yetzer Hara overcame me. I knew it was messianist. Some of these kids have the yarmulkes with the Yechi Adonenu on it. So I gave into my Yetzer Hara. I said, if this big Talmud Chacham from Bnei Brak can daven with them. And by the way, we eat with them. They have a beautiful restaurant and beautiful meals. So I daven with them. And I saw it the first time in my life. I had heard it on the TV, on radio, on the internet. I've seen on YouTube the Yechi, but this is the first time I saw it. Now, let me just go off track for a minute. There was a guy there from America. He's learning there because you can go there and learn for Smicha. It's just a one-year program. Because these guys are not going to be interested in becoming, Rabbanim, of the way we think of it, they're people going down into Kiruv, so they need to be rabbis, they need to have basic Yoredeya and other stuff, so it's a one-year program, and then the rest of it, they can continue learning on their own, but they're rabbis after 1 year. So one of these guys had given a Devar Torah on Shabbos, and he seemed very intelligent, very smart, so I went up to him afterwards. And I'd spoken to him, I had a good relationship, I even gave tzedakah to the community. I said, can I ask you a question? A personal question. And he says, sure. And I said to him, I don't understand. How can you, say this stuff? Yechi Adonenu. I see from your Devar Torah, you're a very smart guy. And he said to me, and I was very impressed when he said it. He said, now he doesn't buy all this stuff. So what is he doing? He's here because, it's a good program. He knows it's a good smicha program. And it's a chance to be in Italy. There's a lot of Kiruv to do here, and it's a wonderful place to be. And therefore, he tolerates it. So then I started thinking, who knows how many other people in these shuls where they say the Yechi really don't buy it, and they just tolerate it. But I never understood where this business of Yechi Adonenu comes from. Now I see that this is the traditional way that rabbis were proclaimed. When they proclaimed rabbis as children, sometimes you'd have a rav and you'd have a search and all that. Other times, you just took the son. And we see that from the son, and you proclaimed him at the funeral, you use this very formula, Yechi Adonenu. And for all I know, maybe even when you hired a rav, and the rav comes to the shul, the first Shabbos, maybe they also proclaimed in front of the rav the same thing, Yechi Adonenu Marina V'Rabbeinu Le'olam. I always thought that this was something made up by Chabad, and so I'm reading the eulogy, reading the description of the Ksav Sofer's funeral, and here I see that when his son takes over, they make this proclamation. So that was really eye-opening for me. Let me speak now a bit about the responsa of the Ksav Sofer, because he was a great respondent, a great meshi. His father, of course, the Ksav Sofer, was the greatest of the 19th century, probably the greatest of the last 200 years. His son was not at that level, obviously. His son was not... the Chasam Sofer was, throughout all of Europe, head and shoulders. I wouldn't say the Ksav Sofer was head and shoulders. In Hungary, he was among the great poskim. Him and the Maharam Shik really stand out as the two greatest of the poskim. In Lithuania, they're not asking the Ksav Sofer questions. In the days of the Chasam Sofer, everyone around the world would ask him questions. In the days of Asaf Sofer, who's asking questions? Rabbanim in Hungary and his students. Most Rabbanim in Hungary are graduates of the Pressburg Yeshiva. But in terms, so I mean, if you're in Lithuania, you have Rabbi Yitzchok Spector, you have other Rabbanim. I guess maybe it's a little later, but you have plenty of Rabbanim. You don't need to ask in Poland, you have Rabbanim. You don't need to ask Asaf Sofer, but he still is one of the two greatest poskim in Hungary. So let me just talk about some of his psakim. We spoke of Chalavetz. Remember that one of the decrees were that you can't have a wedding in a shul. So he was asked, he's not the only one who's asked, many of the Hungarian rabbis were asked this question. He's asked, let's say the community that you're in insists on performing the wedding in the shul. That's what they want to do. In some of these communities, they had been performing weddings in shuls for generations. And they weren't going to follow the Michalowicz decrees. The Kasav Sofer in general did not follow the Michalowicz decrees. For example, he had a preacher, as we saw her. The preacher of the community, which he hired, who used to be the former Rav of Kloisenberg, he preached in German. However, when it came to weddings in the shul, he agreed that no weddings in the shul, because this is the Reform made a big deal about weddings in the shul. So what should you do? Does the rabbi have to refuse to do the wedding in the shul, even if it'll mean the loss of his parnassah, even if it means that he will be fired? These sorts of questions are found throughout the responsa literature. What do you do in a case where the community wants to do something, and if you don't do it, they will simply fire you and get someone else? How much do you need to stand up for your principles, and can you compromise? And all these tshuvot, it's not compromise in the sense, well, you're a weakling. They always refer to the fact that children and a family depends on the rabbi, and telling someone to give up their parnassa, it's not an easy thing to do. And from the standpoint of halacha, it's not an easy thing. So you need a lot of responsibility when you decide these questions. And although, from the standpoint of the Michalowicz decrees, the extremist Hungarians, a Rav is not permitted. He's not permitted to be in a shul where they have a choir. He's not permitted to be in a shul. He's not permitted to serve a community where they have weddings and shuls. And he must leave this community. And there's plenty of tshuvot to deal with these questions. And you have to have faith in God that you'll find another position. But you cannot serve a community that does this. The Kasav Sofer, although he opposes weddings in the shul, you see his more moderate outlook. He says that if it's a choice between losing your position, then matters are more complicated. He says, first of all, we have this idea that you have to rebuke your community. And the first question he was asked, the Kasav Sofer, was, should you rebuke the community and tell them they can't have the weddings in the shul if it means you'll lose your job? And the Kasav Sofer says that the whole principle of rebuke only applies when there is respect for the rabbinic office. When there's an assumption or a good chance that through the rebuke, they'll listen to you. However, if you're certain that you rebuke the community, you'll get up in the pulpit and you rebuke them, and not only won't they listen to you, but they're going to probably fire you, there's no reason to rebuke them. And you don't have to rebuke them. There's no notion of tochacha, of rebuke, if the people are not going to listen. And this is prakalacha to this day. We are under no responsibility as Orthodox Jews to go to non-Orthodox Jews and rebuke them and tell them what you're doing is wrong. If you want to, you know, do some kirov or something, that's one thing. But we don't have to tell them that, because we know they're not going to listen. People don't, and the Chazon Ish goes even further. He says that in today's day and age, no one knows how to properly rebuke. So since we don't know how to properly rebuke, therefore, everyone has the status, even sinners, even the Mechalei Shabbos, they have the status of people who have not yet been rebuked. And if they haven't yet been rebuked, because we don't have the ability to really properly rebuke them today, therefore, they are not regarded as willing sinners. They're regarded as unwitting sinners, because they've never been rebuked. They've never been given warning. They've never been given anything like that. And therefore, we don't regard them as complete heretics that we should have nothing to do with. And part of the reason why we can't properly rebuke them today is because also we don't have, we're not in a traditional Orthodox environment, there's no open miracles, there's all sorts of reasons you can give. But today, we do exactly like the Kesav Sofer says, that you don't need to go ahead and rebuke people. The principle of Mutav Shiyu Shogian. We have a principle that sometimes we are unwitting sinners rather than they're knowing sinners. Well, what do you mean unwitting sinners? If you see someone sinning, you tell him he's sinning, and then he won't be unwitting anymore. But the halacha is that you only are supposed to tell someone if you think they're going to listen, or there's a good chance. If you don't, you're not supposed to tell them, because that makes it even worse. So this has been applied, I know, in communities. If the Erev is down on Shabbos, rabbis will tell certain people, the Erev's down, so they're not going to carry. But if you see all these women came to shul already with their baby carriages, and you know, or you have a good chance of thinking that no matter what you tell them, they're not going to listen to you. At least now, they're not really sinning because they don't know any better. If you tell them, then they're no longer unwitting. They're in a much worse situation. So we will say, Mutav Shiyu Shogegin, Valyum Azidin. Better that they be doing it b'shogeg. They don't know any better. Then they'll be mezidin, that they'll be intentional. And already the Talmud speaks about cases where it's better that people are unwitting sinners than that they're knowing sinners. So Kesav Sofer says there's no obligation to rebuke them because they're not going to listen anyway. But in the Kesav Sofer assumes that you won't have to officiate. He says it's enough not to protest. You don't need to protest, but don't officiate. Refuse to officiate. But he doesn't. The assumption of the tshuva, if I recall, is that they're not going to fire you if you refuse to officiate. If you rebuke them, they get angry at you, then you can lose your job. But if you simply tell them you can't do it, that won't be such a problem. I don't know if the Kesav Sofer would go so far as to say you have to lose your job. He does say not to do it, but I'm going to check. If I recall correctly, he doesn't say to lose your job. Among the Lithuanian rabbis, it never was an issue. They thought that even the ones like Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't believe that you should have weddings and shuls. But if the family wants to have a wedding and shul, don't make a big deal about it. Rav Herzog writes how he always opposed weddings and shuls, but he couldn't, the community insisted on it, so what are you going to do? Bill asked, Rav Shneur Zalman, you mean Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, or Rav Shneur Zalman, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, says that you differentiate for a deraisa where you must rebuke. Email if you think Rav Shneur Zalman or Rav Shlomo Zalman. Yes, some people say that you differentiate between a deraisa and a derabanan, but others say you don't differentiate. The Erev would be an example of a derabanan, because almost everywhere we live, it's not a Torah prohibition to carry. But Lubavitch, Rav Shneur Zalman of Leadi, says if it's a deraisa, you must rebuke them. I get this. I don't think that's the standard position. Just look around. We don't go around rebuking people to begin with. We don't stand on street corners. And even rabbis and shuls. You think back, I don't even have to think back, by the way, to 50 years ago. There's some shuls today where you still have plenty of people who drive on Shabbos, including Lubavitch shuls. There's a little Lubavitch shul right near my house. It's no different than a conservative shul in the fact that everyone drives to shul on Shabbos. The difference is that the Orthodox shul doesn't tell them it's okay. But the Rav does not get it. Rav, people, what you're doing is wrong. No, you teach them. You give a class on Shabbos. You hope people come to it. I don't know. Is there anyone today in the world who believes that you're supposed to rebuke people? If you're a Rosh Yeshiva and you see a yeshiva, one of your students, doing something on Shabbos, like he's maybe doing something which is usher, and he doesn't know, then you rebuke him. Or if you're a rav in a shul and you know someone's a firm person, and maybe he's making his tea improperly on Shabbos, you tell them that, you know, this is not the way to make it. First you have to put the water in, and then you put it in, or whatever you tell them. But if you see someone who's really not religious, who's not making their tea properly, what rabbi goes up and rebukes them and tells them otherwise? So I don't know. You think he means religious people. Well, if you're dealing with religious people, you're always supposed to rebuke them, even for a Darabonon, if you assume that there's a chance that they'll listen to you. If they won't listen to you, then I don't know what the difference is. And if they will listen to you, we don't just rebuke them and tell them about their rights, so we tell them about their abundance also. So we'll have to clarify that there is a tshuva. When I was working at Brandeis, I had this problem, and I had this question, and I asked a rav, a big rav. In fact, the tshuva was published in one of his svarim. I wanted to know what the parameters of Mutav Shiyu Shogin is. And he told me that, you don't need to, if people are not going to listen, you don't need to say it. However, he said, if you're giving a shir and you're learning Shulchan Aruch, you don't skip anything. So even if you're in a room, let's say you're in a shul, and you want to speak about maybe the laws of bishul, of cooking on Shabbos, and you know that there's plenty of people in the room who don't cook properly on Shabbos. And you wouldn't get up in shul necessarily and say this if you thought they wouldn't listen, because of Mutiyav Shu Shogin. But if you're learning, you know, Siman after Siman in the Shulchan Aruch, that you don't skip. You say it. And if the person is sitting there and he learns halacha, and he says, despite learning it, you know, I'm not going to pay attention to that, that's too difficult, too complicated for me, well, then we're not concerned with that. So the guidance I was given was that when you speak publicly, let's say in a drasha, then you don't say certain things, then you apply the idea of mutish yushogin, but when you're learning halacha, you don't skip anything. You read right through, and you're not at all concerned with mutav yushogin, because otherwise, ain't ledav ourself. I mean, you know, you have to learn the halacha. If the guy's coming to a shiur of yours, we're not going to start censoring the Shulchan Aruch because of mutav yushogin. Although, I don't know, maybe some people have a different opinion. Maybe some people would skip those parts of the Shulchan Aruch which they feel that people won't listen to. I don't know. It was Rav Moshe Malka. He was the Rav of Petach Tikva. He was the one who, he died about 10 years ago. He wrote Tshuvos Mikveh Hamayim and Beheshiv Moshe. The Tshuva addressed to me is in Beheshiv Moshe. The reason I wrote to him is because, well, I had been writing to him. There's a number of Tshuvot of him to me. I'd been writing to him because of Rav Yosef Messas, who he was very close to, and Rav Yosef Messas has a whole explanation. We had classes on Rav Yosef Messas on Mutav Shiyu Shogin, so I wanted to get his opinion. He, incidentally, is the rabbi who led the protest, if you're old enough to remember, against the movie theater in Petach Tikva. A movie theater opened up Friday night in Petach Tikva, and the Orthodox community was up in arms because nothing like that had ever happened in Petach Tikva. And he led the, every week, it went on for I think a year, where Friday night they'd go and they'd stand in front of the movie theater. And then he decided that we shouldn't do this anymore. The owners are not listening to us. We've already rebuked them. And since we've already rebuked them, we no longer have any halachic obligation to rebuke anymore. And instead this just causes more Chil Shabbos because the police have to come out, etc. And he published an article in Tehumen saying that there's no longer any obligation and we shouldn't go out and protest. And he published the Haskamot, Rafaim David Alevi and others. And then Rav Yoshev came out with a letter against Rav Moshe Malka saying, no, what you were doing up to now is okay and you have to continue doing it. And it's a very interesting issue of Tehumen, which has the tshuvot of Rav Moshe Malka and others, or Rav Kafach on one side, saying that we no longer have, once you've rebuked them, we no longer have this. And Rav Moshe Malka responded, he says, this is nonsense, it makes no sense. I'm supposed to stand out Friday night, basically saying, stand like an idiot with a sign saying Shabbos, in front of these Mechalei Shabbos, who've seen us now for months and months, and don't care. What do we need to stand out? These people, obviously, we've rebuked them, they don't care anymore. And Rav Yosha's perspective was that Shabbos, you need to rebuke for the sake of Shabbos. So it's a very interesting debate on responsibility for rebuke, for Shabbos. So that is the person who gave me this psak, Rav Moshe Malka, who was the Rav of Petach Tikva, a Moroccan, incidentally. I see it's already 10 o'clock. There's a few more tshuvot, interesting tshuvot of the Ksav Sofer I want to do, and then next class we will pick up right with, let me show you who we're going to pick up with. with Ramosha Kunitz, those who came to Budapest last summer. We went to his grave. There is a picture of Ramosha Kunitz. Any other questions before we end? Again, I thank you all for being here. This is a shorter semester. We're only going to go 6 weeks. That means we only have 5 weeks after that. But as always, I'm sure we will learn a great deal, and I will learn a great deal from all of your comments or questions. So I'll wait on for one more minute if anyone has any other comments. Okay, I don't see anyone typing. So I will see you all next week, and good night, everyone.